with issue for all women.
Hello, Jen here to tell you about this week's episode of The Sunday Chops, in which I'm talking to playwright and stone cold legend slash powerhouse, Susie Miller. Before I do that, I need to tell you about Patreon. As many of you will know, we've got a Patreon page. We don't really like to talk about it, but talk about it we must. I'll level with you. It's hard out here in a post-pandemic podcasting world. If you love what we do and you want to help us in our endeavours to bring you more women-centred content, we'd love it if you would consider alleviating yourself of those pesky adverts by subscribing to it for as little as £1 per month. Now, if you're feeling flush, you can give us a bit more, for which, in the very near future, you'll be getting a lot more by doing so. If you can't spare the cash, and we do get it, we really do, please hit subscribe if you've not done so already, and we'll get more of that sweet, sweet advertising, sorry, did I just call it pesky, monies. And you don't have to do anything other than, you know, hit subscribe, ovs. We appreciate you, lovely listeners. Back to this episode. Playwright Susie Miller is best known for her award-sweeping masterpiece, Prima Facie. I know, I thought it was Prima too, but it is Prima. A searing critique of the criminal justice system and specifically how it deals with survivors of sexual assault and rape. She's now adapted the play into a novel, and so I was absolutely chuffed to bits to talk to her about the process of adaptation, as well as why she wrote it, the impact the play has had, and the sheer lunacy of a system that simply isn't fit for purpose. I've honestly never heard anyone speak in such a matter-of-fact, measured and sensible way about these topics, and even though this is the stuff we talk about at Standard Issue week in, week out, I really felt like I learned a lot from chatting to her. So I hope that you do too, and I hope that you seek out her book because it is amazing. I'm delighted to say that I'm joined by Susie Miller, playwright and author of new book, Prima Facie, adapted from her multiple award-winning play of the same name. Susie, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, thank you. It's lovely to be here.
I think a lot of people will have heard of the play because obviously it, you know, made pretty big waves over here and indeed, you know, around the world. But for those listeners who maybe don't know too much about it, could you tell us a little bit about Prima Facie first of all, please?
Cool. So Prima Facie had a run in Australia and then it went straight to the West End and in a British production, because I sort of identify as British-Australian or Australian-British, whichever one. And because I do a lot of my work over in London, and you know, this is, London is so much the centre of theatre and it's such an exciting place to actually have your work developed and put on as well. So we went straight to the West End with Jodie Comer, who'd never actually been on the West End. In fact, had only ever done a very short monologue in Liverpool in the past. So this was her stage debut, and it's about 100 minutes on stage. It's a one-woman show that's pretty intense and quite fast-paced. There's a lot of action, and in fact, because we had a healthy production budget, thanks to a producer that really believed in the show, we had some really exciting things happen on stage as well. We had a great director, a great designer. It was a team that's so organic. In fact, we're all having a reunion on Friday night because we're all so close, so it was quite a lovely experience. Anyway, it went to the West End and straight away it had a standing ovation and people just weeping on the very first preview, which has continued throughout. It happened in Australia as well. It's happened at every performance, like almost 100% standing ovation immediately, multiple callbacks and a very emotional response from audiences. So, you know, you don't expect that when you write a play. I mean, you write a play in isolation on your own somewhere. And then, you know, and I wrote it because I had this real need to write this particular play. I've thought about the issues for a very long time. And as I wrote it, I thought, you know, it's actually going to be a book as well, because there's so much I have to take out in order to make it a 100-minute play. Otherwise, it'd be a 6-hour play. And so once the play had sort of taken off, I sort of put my head back down and started writing the book.
How did it come about? So you wrote the play first, you said, but you'd always intended to write it as a book. Was it difficult to do? Because as you say, it's a one-woman show. So then obviously to then sort of develop it around that, or had you kind of largely done all of that in the knowledge that you always wanted it to be a book as well?
Well, I think what people don't realise about a monodrama, which is a one-woman show, is that you develop all the characters anyway, because it actually plays all the characters. And so I had a very strong understanding of all of the characters. And when I did the research and the note-taking for the play, of course, I had so much information. and had to sort of, as they say in theatre, kill your darlings, take some of the scenes out that I was very connected to and that I, you know, that were very emotional, but I, you know, didn't work on stage. So I needed to find a way to have another piece of writing that actually included all of that as well. Having said that, it's a different genre, so there's more sort of psychological excavation in the novel.
The play and indeed the novel are about a young woman who is a barrister and she is the victim of a serious sexual assault. Then it is about her navigating the legal system that she is very much part of. Can you tell me a little bit more about that? Because you are from a legal background.
Yeah. So basically the story is about Tessa, and Tessa's our protagonist. She's actually from a working class background in Liverpool. And because she's very bright, she's basically had scholarships all the way through and worked really hard. And she's ended up at the bar doing exceptionally well. And she's surrounded by people who grew up with the law, whose parents were lawyers, who knew lawyers. And for her, it's a completely alien environment, but she's really proven herself within it. So the law was a bit of a saving grace for her. It has given her financial security. It's given her a voice. It's given her the capacity to show how good she is at something. And she believes in it. And she believes in the legal structure and the legal system, which often most lawyers do, obviously. And so she goes to court and she defends people accused of criminal activity, including people that are accused of sexual assault and rape. And she has a remarkable win record. Now, what happens then is that she gets connected to someone at work, another barrister who comes from one of those like quite connected legal families. His father's a QC, his mother's very well known. And they start dating. And then on a particular day, you know, they have consensual sex. And then later in the night, he actually rapes her. They have non-consensual sex. And trying to decipher how you make that statement and how you follow that through the legal system, she starts to recognize that these are the major form of most sexual assaults. And yet it's almost impossible for the prosecution to win those cases because of the way the legal system's set up. So basically in the UK, we have 1 in 3 women are sexually assaulted or raped. Out of those 1 in 3, 1 in 10 will take it to the police. And out of those 1 in 10, very few go to court. And then when they get to court, there's a 1.3% conviction rate. Now, a 1.3% conviction rate when it's already been so profoundly filtered to get there is sort of an indicator that something's not working.
Yeah, the statistic, I think probably a lot of people, there's a lot of news stories about it in the UK, certainly about, you know, some people are calling it essentially the decriminalisation of rape. Mm-hmm. And because obviously we talk about this kind of stuff a lot on the podcast, you know, we talk about the news and things like that. And so we do quite a lot of digging around in the statistics. I think what a lot of people won't realise, they may realise that that conviction rate is very, very low, but the percentage of cases that then do get reported to the police but actually drop out at that stage is enormously high.
Yeah, and that's a number of reasons. One is that, you know, the process of reporting to the police and then having it taken to the Director of Public Prosecutions, there's a process where having reported it to the police and having been asked questions that make someone feel very uncomfortable, feel that they're being doubted, feel that they're being shamed because of the nature of the questions, means that they just decide they don't want to go any further with it. The next issue is that even if they do, the he said, she said evidence of sexual assault makes it very difficult for the prosecution to decide that one's the sort of case that they can take forward because they're very hard to prove. And then when they do, someone might decide at that point that they're now just absolutely traumatized by the wait, because often it's 2-3 year wait before you actually court. So you don't know what happens in the meantime. And of course, by the time they've told their story so many times, it's actually extremely re-traumatizing. And there's all sorts of inconsistencies that people start to throw at them. And they don't, and I think someone that's a sexual assault survivor, victim survivor, find themselves in a situation where they're constantly doubted in order to be prepared for court. And I think that just damages somebody and they don't want to take it further. But having said that, a lot of them, the DPP can't take forward because they don't see how you could win in court. Not because someone's not telling the truth, but because the system requires the prosecution to not only prove that the complainant wasn't consenting, but also prove that the perpetrator knew they weren't consenting. So just because someone's not consenting, it's not enough to fix someone. Having said that, the perpetrator or the alleged perpetrator never has to even give evidence in court. You can just undermine the complainant constantly. And the problem with that process is that in undermining a complainant of sexual assault is you rehash a number of rape myths that are completely irrelevant to the crime. So by asking someone, well, you wore that, or you had that drinks, or you invited him back to your house, none of those are evidence that indicates that someone's consenting to the sex that they had that was non-consensual. But it's actually referred to the jury, which of course is reflective of the community at large, which does have these gendered myths about, you know, if you're going to go out wearing that, what do you expect? But of course, in a modern age, we know that that's ludicrous to think that by wearing a certain outfit, you're inviting rape. Is just astonishing to think that in this day and age.
So I had an experience some time ago now where I reported a man to the police. It was sort of one of those kind of grey area. There's nothing grey about it. He committed a crime against me, but wasn't like a physical assault, but it was image based. But it was one of those things where like some of it was, there was a bit of consensual stuff and a bit of like very much non-consensual stuff.
Which is 99% of what these stories are. The one, whether it's an innocent person home from school, dragged off the side of the road, they're
quite rare. Yeah. We don't teach boys or girls very much about consent. We don't really teach them what it means. So this is the sort of thing that, you know, Ken Clark, I don't know if you are familiar with Ken Clark. He's a sort of veteran British politician who was, I think he must have been Justice Secretary for a while, but this is going back a bit now, but he referred to serious and non-serious rapes. So,
but even the fact that can exist means that they're not understanding a woman's lived experience of that process. So I think that that's so much part of the problem, because the law has been decided by and invented by generations and generations, hundreds of years of white, privileged, very privileged, moneyed even, heterosexual men. And so that story, the counter story, has never been part of the formation of assault law. And in fact, right up until the 90s, you could not rape your wife because they'd consented. But I guess that gives you an indication of what we're basing sexual assault ideology on, that if that's the basis that you can't rape your wife, then any exception to the sort of consent that's assumed in marriage is a big jump for the law. But it's not a big jump if it's the lived experience of women, and one in three women have had that experience. So I guess the other thing is that in terms of educating men, I mean, one of the things that the play and the books really advocates, but the play has set up a thing called the Schools Consent Project, which is, barristers volunteer to go out to schools and talk about what consent is. And one of the things that I realised when the play was on, because there were some schools that came with, you know, 14-year-old boys, and they didn't know that that was rape because they had sex earlier in the night. And I thought, well, they don't know what consent is and isn't. But one of the other things I realised is when you say to boys, you know, do you know about consent? They go, yeah, no means no. And I go, well, not just no, other things as well, no. And it's about having a conversation, and you should really be leaning towards yes means yes and actually saying, is this okay? Because it's not a big ask to say to someone when you're actually involved in such an intimate kind of biological and sort of emotional transaction to say, is this okay? Like, you know, why is that so scary for people to have to ask? That surely you're doing that anyway on some level. So I guess that's what we need to sort of repack and interrogate the paradigm about why that's not what we teach people.
I wonder a little bit if there is almost like a sort of, within the CPS, like a desensitization almost.
Well, I think it's reflective of the community at large, though. And the difference with CPS is, of course, they're going, well, what happens if we take these cases and lose? Well, we're not going to, you know, our funding's going to be affected by that on some level because we're using our resources for cases we can't get up in court.
But that's miserable, isn't it? I mean,
but I guess if they can't get up in court, then you sort of go, well, what's wrong with the entire system, that this is the message CPS are getting when they run them? And, you know, I think that there's, I mean, to me, it's actually ripe for kind of interrogation and ideas around change and incorporating a woman's experience into what that paradigm is. Because one of the things that I really emphasize this in the book is that you see what happens to Tessa and you're there live with her. And there's, I froze. I didn't know what to do. I froze and I was trying to figure out a way to survive it. And of course, when I was a lawyer, I used to take 6 statements a week from young women who'd been sexually assaulted to get compensation for them so that they could actually have some therapy. So they hadn't actually taken it to the police yet, but they needed to have some kind of therapy because they weren't coping. And every single statement I took was so similar. Like, so often, one of the things that the male paradigm of like any sort of violence.
Yeah, why didn't you fight back, or why didn't you resist? Yeah.
Yeah. So this idea that fight or flight are the only two appropriate responses when you're in danger is very male determined, because, you know, maybe you do have the chance to sort of beat someone and or outrun them. But when you're physically so much smaller or have so much less capacity, really what that is, you know, you're probably provoking someone to be more violent towards you. So actually, from a woman's perspective, when what they do is freeze or friend, the other two Fs that are silent generally, is a really great survival technique. You think, okay, they're going to freeze and just figure out a way to get out of that as soon as they can, or they're going to try and talk the person out of it so that they can get out of the room and then get away.
Yeah.
And really legitimate survival techniques. Women are never rewarded for having a response that's about survival. It's like, well, you should have screamed and yelled and fought anything and risk, you know, like what is already such a violent overture that you think, well, he could kill me. I mean, women don't walk home from the tube with their keys out and their phone somewhere and being hypervigilant on the street because they're scared someone's going to steal their backpack. They're scared they're going to be raped and murdered. So that's 52% of the population walk home with that level of vigilance about those two particular things. It just shows you that, and men are shocked when they hear that their girlfriends or their partners or even, you know, their daughters have that level of fear, and you go, oh, well, we're so used to it that we've forgotten that it's actually outrageous that we do.
I remember in the Me Too movement, I remember saying to my brother, you know, I don't have a friend, a female friend, who has not experienced something that is arguably sexual assault. I just don't know anyone who hasn't had one of those experiences. Yeah. And he was like, what? I was like, yeah, no, I mean, it's just completely normalized. Like, you would be absolutely shocked. And I told him about some of the experiences some of my friends had had, and he was horrified.
Men are horrified when they hear it like that from people they know. But happened out there in the community is that what we've allowed to proliferate are these rape myths, this idea that, oh, she's just doing it because she's jealous, or she's just doing it because she got dumped, or she's doing it because she regrets sleeping with him. And you think, I'm sorry, but in this day and age where women have real sexual autonomy and they're out dating and they're out obviously having physical relationships with people before they're married or whatever, if you regret sleeping with someone, you don't then draw attention to it.
But, quite,
you know, it's like you just don't tell anyone. Your virginity is not this precious thing that you have to maintain publicly anymore. That falls apart at the seams, but it's still used in court that you just regretted having sex with him, didn't you? And, you know, you wanted to make sure that you didn't get the blame for it. You think, I don't know anyone who's that terrified of having to confess that, you know, if they are, they just don't tell anyone. So I guess what happens in the adversarial system is you set two people up, two different lawyers up, and because only one person is giving evidence, you know, specifically the complainant woman, and that person is also the person who is the body, the evidence for the sexual assault and rape, the crime happened on her body. So it's a crime scene. And so she's expected to respond to all of the questions from both sides. And in order to undermine her story, the defense strategy is to give her other motivations for taking it to court and for calling it rape. And one of those is to minimize what happened and say, well, really, it was just consensual sex that you changed your mind about. Or really, once you found out he had like another lover that upset you and you wanted to make sure he was punished, and you think, wow, there's so many other ways people could do that. It's insane. I mean, especially with social media. I mean, if that was your motivation, to wait 3 years to go to court and go through the level of trauma that the justice system puts you through, it's not logical to keep assuming that. And, you know, like, so all of those rape myths are very much still quite active. And other ones, like even questioning someone before a jury by saying, well, you wore this out, you wore, you know, a very short skirt or whatever, or saying even things like, you invited him to your house and to your bed. And this idea, and the shaming factor that some women have internalized and actually go, yeah, I realize what you're saying is it's partially my fault. And of course, it's not, you're not asking someone or inviting someone to rape you. You're inviting, you're having a trust relationship with somebody. So the other alternative is that apparently you have to never trust a single human being, particularly a male, and never start a relationship with anyone. I mean, that's antiquated as well. So, I mean, I think that the system needs to actually change, and perhaps there's a few possibilities in how it can. We could have special sexual assault courts where there is inherent support for the person that's giving the evidence. Doesn't mean you get more convictions necessarily, but hopefully you're at least not re-traumatized by the process. That you might have an expert psychiatrist that would actually be able to say, well, that is a really appropriate response to freeze or friend, or, you know, to lie afterwards for a little while, to stay in bed afterwards for a little while, figuring out a way to escape before you leave, like, or even hugging the person goodbye so you can get out of the place. I mean, they're really appropriate, you know, scenarios just to survive it and get away. The other thing is, you know, the possibility of changing the law. So once we can prove that someone said, I wasn't consenting, to a sort of lower standard, then the onus shifts to the defense to actually prove why they think they were consenting. Why do we just assume that consent exists until a woman can prove she wasn't? I mean, it's just, it's kind of outrageous to me that you don't have a positive consent model. And it is being looked at the moment, this idea of affirmative consent.
It does seem weird, doesn't it? Because if you think about it, we don't walk around having sex with every man we meet.
Yeah.
Or on every possible occasion that we could. So surely the onus should be to prove that consent was there. Absolutely. Like, it would make more sense to have to prove that consent existed.
But also to train our boys to say, because you have sex once in the night doesn't mean it's an open slather of consent for the rest of... I mean, you know, someone changes their mind even halfway through. You just got to be up for that. And I think also just... you know, this defensiveness that comes from the kind of like the kind of voice of men saying, oh, this is ridiculous. Why should we have to worry about all that? And you think, well, why haven't you been?
Well, quite, yeah.
Because it makes it harder for them to understand it. Somehow or other, it therefore shouldn't be their problem. It should be the problem of women. And therefore, they have to find out reasons women are lying rather than today. Well, that was their experience of something that I assumed was consensual.
So there's another layer to this as well, which you pick up on in the book and in the play. I mean, we see stories all the time about how women are dismissed and, you know, and the legal system is not kind to them. But there are kind of like varying degrees of that, depending on class, race, et cetera, et cetera.
Absolutely.
And this is something that you pick up on in the book.
I mean, I really wanted the character to sort of exhibit that intersection between how class and gender really discriminate against somebody. And, you know, the invisibility of class. And yet, you know, when even though she's taken so much to get there, I mean, in effect, she's done everything three times as everybody else just in order to be at the same place that they're all at. You know, she had to sort of figure out all the systems herself. She had to sort of get herself to university under a situation where it wasn't expected and it wasn't likely. She had to then get herself to the bar. She's done all of that. But all of the other people that she's at the bar with mostly have educated parents or people that can sort of template what it's like to be a lawyer or even a professional. And the other thing is that, you know, once this happens to her, the man that rapes her is someone who's from a legal family and gets sort of the best possible defense lawyer. And there's a certain presence in court of his whole family, very educated, very well known. His father's a QC or KC, as the case would be now. And as a consequence, what happens is she's actually aware that the sort of full force of the law is really on the defense side in this matter, which means that she's aware that she just doesn't have the kind of private school networks. He's got a whole bunch of his friends in the gallery that, you know, are sort of his sort of champions. And she's got her mum and her brother who are quite scared to be in court, basically, and her brother's sister who's got a child. So she has to sit outside the court because you can't bring small children in. And I guess it's just recognizing that incredible imbalance of like power and power structures have so many different ways of alienating somebody from a system, but also recognizing the legal system right from the beginning. Even though she's a barrister, she goes into the police station and she's still a traumatized person. And she gets asked questions that have a kind of implicit re-traumatizing and also an implicit, oh God, this is hopeless, this case. Or, well, why didn't you do X? Or why did you do that? In asking those questions, it's making her doubt her own voice right from the very beginning. And I think what's interesting about that is that 3,000 police officers saw a film of the play, in North Yorkshire, and they had a big day of discussing how they take statements. And I had like emails from and DMs from some of them saying this was a profound experience. And I had one inspector say, for 30 years I've been taking these statements and I realize I've been doing it wrong. And from now on, I won't be.
Wow.
One of the things that I say in the book is once you see, you cannot unsee. And I think that in lots of cases of injustice, but particularly with the experience of someone that's not from the dominant paradigm, you don't actively seek out how they view it or how they experience something. But once you see it, you go, oh, wow, of course. You know, like, oh, boy, we're really making it worse for them. And I think that happens with race, with class, with gender, with disability, all across the board. You know, and yet we sort of have this idea that the legal system is equal for all people, and it's not. It's very clearly not.
As you said already, you're from a legal background. One of the first things that occurred to me reading this is that not only is the legal profession kind of set out as this old boys network, which is one of the things that goes against you when you're trying to navigate your way through it as a woman, and you know, and various other, as you've discussed, you know, race, class, gender, disability, etc. But the thing that really jumped out to me is that on top of that, the lawyers acting within that, it's kind of like a game, yeah. Right? And I wondered, A, if that is your experience of the law when you were working within it, and B, is that an appropriate way of settling complex cases, you know, with very serious real world consequences for people?
Well, I guess I have to point out that yes, it is a bit like that, but also it's because people are performing in court. And also to point out that on the opposite side of that is that lawyers are not that important. Really, they're just giving the best version of their client's story in the most strategic way possible so that their client has the best version of their story before the judge and jury. And then the prosecution is trying to do the same thing for the person they're representing. And so actually you're not the decision maker. You're not the person that takes responsibility for what happens. But ultimately your job is to just give the best version of your client's story. Now that's all well and good as long as everything else is equal and fair. The problem is it's not. So that, you know, when you're making the best case for a sexual assault client and giving, I mean, I never did sexual assault, but I know lots of women that did. And they're saying, I'm doing the right thing. I'm just putting their story before the court. If the court doesn't find him guilty, you know, obviously I did my job well, but the prosecution has to do as good a job as me in order to get their case across. And maybe they didn't do their job as well. But the problem is what I now know when I've seen what the prosecution go through is the amount of hurdles in sexual assault they have to get over. And the fact of their very vulnerable complainant, who's also their body is the scene of the crime, is that one of the main ways defense lawyers undermine the story of the other person is to say, well, you're being inconsistent, or your story is not being told in a kind of logical, easy fashion. And one of the things that comes up constantly, and actually now one of the judges has actually seen the play, read the book, and actually made a change to this, is that they say, you know, like if someone's traumatized, they remember the perpetrator, they remember what happened. They might not remember it in task by task detail, and they might not remember bits of peripheral evidence, like what color the lamp was or whatever. Or they might get the timing a bit wrong. You know, and consistency is important. But as I say in the play, one of the judges here in Liverpool quoted it back to me last night, and he said, this was really important. And what really threw me, he said, is that you say, While consistency is important, we can't use consistency as a litmus test, because sometimes you're telling the truth, but the traumatized person has remembered it slightly off kilter. It doesn't mean they're lying, though. So the assumption is if someone's inconsistent or they don't remember other elements, it means that the assumption or the implicit assumption is that they're making it up. And that's actually not always the case, obviously, in any criminal matter, but particularly if you're someone who has been the victim of a violent crime and you're trying to recall it.
Susie, I could talk to you about this for like ever and ever and ever, but unfortunately we're going to run out of time. Do you have any social media where our listeners can follow you to keep up to date with what you're doing? Because I'm sure you've got all sorts of other things going on.
This Susie Miller Writer on Instagram is the best way. And it's like I have some people that help me collate it, but certainly there's lots of information about the play, where it's playing all over the world, and also the book, where it's being launched in various languages. The audiobook is already number 7, and the book is in the top 10 in Amazon. So already there's a vibe, and it's only being launched tomorrow. But I think Jodie doing the audiobook, she does an incredible job as well. So it's really a shout out to her, because she's really a compatriot of mine in this whole kind of argument against some of the issues with sexual assault.
She's fantastic, isn't she? I know lots of people who saw the play instantly and were absolutely blown away by it. So, yeah, you know, I don't think you really need me to give you props, Susie, but props to you and props to Jodie.
Well, I appreciate it. I operate in a bit of a dark room mostly, so yeah.
Susie, thank you so much for joining me. The book is published by Hutchinson Heinemann and is available now. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. Have a great day.
Standard Issue, for all women.